It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good
morning. Very bad week for if you live in Iraq.
Yeah, you don't wanna...
Particularly certain parts of Iraq, yeah.
Yeah, if you're planning on leaving the U.S. after the presidential election, you don't want to move to Iraq, that's for sure.
Yeah, so those those offers you might have gotten for, like, free flights there.
Well, that's a... I get those all the time. That's a reminder of the old truism of the one reason you don't want to leave the United States is you don't want to become a victim of U.S. foreign policy.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I actually saw in the letters to the editor this week for people that are interested that, you know, people are talking about after the elections of moving to Canada. I actually saw somebody writing a letter to the editor saying, anybody that wants to move to Canada, I'll pay your bus ticket. So I think we should get that person.
Yeah, you should get that person's name and call him up.
Put that out there. Anyway, so obviously this week Iraq is the big news. So I guess we'll start with
Iraq is the big news.
This week in Iraq.
I want to talk about Fallujah, the attack on Fallujah, mostly the effect on the city and the people. Now, on Monday, the French press agency reported in a headline that said, "Skies burned red above Fallujah as U.S.-led forces storm rebel city." They reported the following: "Missiles rained down indiscriminately on the city, with the action most intense in the Askari district in the northeast and Jolan in the northwest." Now, Jolan is a residential neighborhood. I want to point that out right now. They also said, quote, "They are in the process of incinerating the sector," according to a Jolan local who lived in that area. Now, U.S. forces seized the general hospital immediately, and within the space of about 2 days, they bombed two of the three medical clinics in the city, and the third one was not operating because of lack of medicines because of the siege before the bombing started. Ambulances were confiscated and destroyed when ambulance was bombed. 20 doctors and dozens of patients died when one of the clinics was bombed. There was also no medicines coming into the city and no places for doctors to treat people. So many of the wounded civilians inside Fallujah, and there were a lot of them, were dying of their injuries without treatment. Now, civilians couldn't leave their homes because U.S. snipers were shooting at anything that moved. And if you paid attention to the BBC, which had two reporters embedded with troops in Fallujah, and they were reporting in real time, you got a pretty good picture of what that was all about, because they reported troops who were saying, yeah, you know, I'm shooting at anything that moves, whether it's a bird, whether it's a mouse, whether it's a person, without any attention paid to whether they were civilians or insurgents. Now, on Tuesday, the French press agency described the neighborhood of Jolan as, quote, "a wasteland of shattered glass and rubble." Fadril al-Badrani, he's a correspondent for the BBC and Reuters, was actually inside Fallujah when the bombing started, and he's been in the city the whole week and sending reports to both BBC and Reuters. He said on Tuesday that the artillery and bombing was intense. Quote, "Every minute, hundreds of bombs and shells are exploding. The north of the city is in flames. Fallujah has become like hell." Now, electricity and water were cut off because of the bombing. The main power station was one of the places that was hit by a U.S. bomb. Two BBC reporters embedded with U.S. troops, Jennifer Glass and Paul Wood, described, quote, "the overwhelming force," end quote, being used by U.S. troops. At one point, Glass said, quote, "The operation has entered a sensitive stage. U.S. forces want to take the city, but there has to be a city left to take." That gives you some idea of what she's seeing on the ground in Fallujah. The Associated Press, and this is interesting because much of what you got from what was going on in Fallujah, much of the good, accurate news, you could find from the Associated Press and Reuters and from the BBC, who had reporters inside the city and with U.S. troops, but you didn't see a whole lot of that leaking out to the U.S. press or in the U.S. papers or U.S. coverage. Now, the Associated Press reported on Wednesday, quote, anxious to avoid a repeat of the failed siege of the city last April, the U.S. commander has thrown about three times as many troops into the fight this time, along with an array of sophisticated weaponry to include tanks, artillery, AC-130 gunships, attack helicopters, and jets. Now, all of that air power, which is what the U.S. used mostly whenever they encountered any kind of firing from the insurgents, they would call in an airstrike. There was so much air power over the city that the U.S. military had to stack the planes and helicopters. So on one level, they would have the helicopters. Above that, they would have planes. Above that, they would have reconnaissance drones. And they spent a lot of time coordinating all of that stuff to make sure that none of those aircraft hit each other. But those aircraft were hitting targets in the city all the time. Now, by Thursday, Fadil al-Badrani told the BBC that dead bodies lined the streets of Fallujah, dead women and children among them, and that the stench was unbearable. The minarets of several mosques had been toppled. People were beginning to grow weak from hunger, and families were burying their dead in their gardens because they were not able to go outside and take them to a hospital or a morgue or any place like that. Not that there was any hospital available for them to take them to. Now, on Friday, Reuters reported that TV footage showed some districts in the city were all but leveled. That's not just one district, Jolin, but some districts. So the city has suffered a lot of destruction. U.S. soldiers were letting women and children out of the city by Friday, but they were turning back all males between the ages of 15 and 55 to fend for themselves in a city that's pretty much become an inferno. At the end of the week on Friday, U.S. troops were reporting that they controlled 70 to 80% of the city, while Reuters and BBC reporters inside the city said they thought it was closer to about 50%. Now, that's what's going on in Fallujah. I also want to talk about what's happening in the rest of Iraq while Fallujah is being destroyed. There was, I think you could call it a major Sunni uprising all over central and northern Iraq. Started in Bakuba when rebels attacked three police stations and killed 45 policemen, pretty much took over the city of Bakuba and have been fighting there ever since with U.S. troops. Rebels also took over the city of Ramadi, that's the capital of Anbar province, on Wednesday. There were no Iraqi police left inside the city, and U.S. troops were forced to pull out of Ramadi and back to their base on the outskirts of town. That allowed the rebels to patrol the streets with Kalashnikovs, heavy machine guns, and shoulder-fired missiles. Now, that's Ramadi, the capital city of Anbar province. Samarra, in the city of Samarra, a string of suicide bombings of police stations killed more than 30 Iraqi police and National Guard over last weekend, and then skirmishes occurred throughout the week, and the U.S. command sent fighter jets to bomb portions of the city of Samarra in order to try to get control of a city that was supposedly pacified in September and was supposed to be a model for the rest of the Sunni heartland of how the U.S. wanted to control that part of the country. Now, the big news is the city of Mosul, which is the third largest city in Iraq. Armed men surged into the city from all directions on Tuesday. They raided police stations and government buildings, set up roadblocks, and searched passerbys. On Wednesday, nine police stations were overrun by guerrillas, and in some cases, Iraqi police simply turned over their weapons without a fight. By the end of the week, five police stations had been completely destroyed. Government buildings had been taken over. U.S. troops battled to keep control of major bridges in Mosul, and they finally called in airstrikes on Thursday. However, by Friday, both Reuters reporter Maher Al-Thanoun and Associated Press reporter Robert Reed both reported that there were no U.S. troops, no Iraqi police, no Iraqi National Guard on the streets of Mosul, that it was entirely in the hands of the insurgents.
So we've traded us, we've leveled a city of 500,000 in Fallujah, a city that no longer really exists. We've traded that for a city of what, 2-3 million in Mosul?
Yeah, Mosul is a city of about 3 million people now in the hands of the Iraqi insurgents. So yeah, they traded a city of about 300,000 to 500,000 people, which is about half destroyed, for a city of about 3 million people, which is now in the hands of the rebels. Now, you will only get that news if you read the Associated Press wire service or the Reuters wire service. If you read the U.S. newspapers, what you get is reporting of what the U.S. military says about Mosul, yeah, which is, oh, no, everything is under control. That is not true. Reuters and Associated Press have reporters on the ground in Mosul, and they report that it is not in U.S. hands.
Well, it's under control. It's just under control of the other guys.
Yeah, the other guys. Now, the Iraqi interim government fired the chief of police in Mosul and rushed four brigades of Iraqi National Guardsmen to Mosul to try to help take the city back. And currently, from what I can tell, there's a lot of fighting going on the outskirts. Now, in Baghdad, in the capital city, fighting erupted in at least four districts and has continued throughout the week. In addition to the usual roadside bombings and suicide car bombs, you now have guerrillas fighting, attacking police stations and fighting U.S. troops in various neighborhoods throughout the capital city of Baghdad. In addition, major attacks happened in Karbala, Balad, Baiji, Tuz, Muatasim, Mahmoudia, Tikrit, Hawija, and Tal Afar, and probably other places that I could not find information about in the U.S. newspapers. Meanwhile, the Pentagon was forced to admit that attacking Fallujah will not quell the insurgency. Well, no kidding. And that wraps up this week in Iraq.
All right.
Well, that was cheerful.
Yeah.
We told them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been saying all along, you attack cities like that, it's not going to help. It's just going to make the problem worse.
You're creating more insurgents is what you're doing.
Yeah, and I don't see how creating a refugee population of some 300,000 to 500,000 people who used to live in Fallujah is going to not fuel the insurgency. I don't see how that can happen. I mean, you kick those people out of their homes, you destroy them, you starve them half to death. They're going to want to join the insurgency, don't you think?
And not just them, but they have relatives in other parts of Iraq as well. And those stories are circulating. That gets around.
That's very true.
Well, and you also have to wonder when the leadership there, the U.S. Military Command there in Fallujah, reported like on the second day in that they knew that there was none of the command structure for the people they supposedly went in for, they would continue an operation like
that. Yeah, none of the insurgent leaders were in Fallujah anymore. By day two, they knew that. Why would they continue to try to destroy the city? That's a good question.
Well, I think they're trying to do it as an example to other cities in Iraq that you don't want to, this is what happens if you allow your city to be taken over by the insurgents. But that's, you know, they cannot do this to all of Iraq. They simply can't level the entire country.
Right.
I mean, they can, but it would be suicidal.
Yeah, the rationale Donald Rumsfeld gave in a press conference this week was, you know, this is a paraphrase of what he said, but it was, if we keep bombing them and destroying their cities, eventually the Iraqi people will say, we don't want this anymore. What we want is elections. I think that's faulty reasoning.
Absurd reasoning is what it is.
When you keep bombing them, destroying their cities, I think their reasoning is going to be, well, you bomb us, we'll bomb you. And that's clearly what's happening.
Yeah.
All right. Well, jumping back a lot closer to home, the Seattle City Council wrestled this week with the city budget, and looks like they fixed some things that...
Yeah, it's not a final vote. The final vote will come on, I believe, the 22nd with the full city council, but the budget committee of city council managed to restore a number of the cuts that were suggested in the original budget proposal by Greg Nichols, and they did it by imposing a 1.6% increase in utility tax. Now, this is a fairly regressive tax. It obviously, you know, poor people and rich people alike need to heat their homes and keep the lights going. But for that, they managed to scuttle the increase, the beginning of parking lot charges in the city parks. They managed to restore a number of the social service cuts. They managed to restore the fee at the conservatory and in Volunteer Park. They managed to restore a number of the things that were cut in the original proposal, and none of the social service agencies that were doing as much as fasting on the steps of City Hall to try and call attention to this. It's very much a temporary solution. These problems are going to be with the city again next year, and part of the problem is that the city council, in making a number of these restorations, is counting on an improvement in the city economy, in an uptick that, in the words of one city council person, we've been waiting a long time for. Well, we've been waiting a long time for it, and it hasn't happened, and there's not a whole lot of evidence that it's going to happen in the next year. And the city council is relying on those revenue increases to help forestall the the shortfall that was the reason for Nichols' cuts in the first place.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was reading up on that this morning, and also have seen in the last couple of days the deal with the Key Arena and the Sonics, and our local budget is just a fiasco.
Well, we were talking about this off the air before we started, that a big part of the problem for this is having paid for so many of the capital projects and other projects through the use of bonds. You have to pay off those bonds when they're brought in, and you don't have a choice of defaulting on them, and that means coming up with other kind of creative budgetary solutions in other parts of the budget, because you know you simply can't allow that to slip, and that's what happened with Key Arena. Where the Sonics don't want to pay their share. That's what happened with the Opera House, where those are coming due now. And one of the things that did not get is getting into the city budget this time that was not there was a pledge not to have that happen was that that the city council is helping to bail out the Opera House and contribute some money. I think a couple $100,000 to the payments of the bonds for the Opera House. That was originally supposed to go into user fees onto the tickets of Opera House users, and that's simply not happening.
Part of that's probably because the economy is down and arts organizations are having a hard time drawing the audience members they used to have in the past, and that's something you have to expect.
And not just the audience members, but they're having a hard time fundraising as well.
Yeah, so something you have to expect. And so when the city goes to the opera and the ballet and says, can you kick in and help us make the interest payments on these bonds, they can't expect those two organizations to be able to cough up much money because they're hurting too. You know, and so, of course, those interest payments will have to come from somewhere, and they have to come out of the city budget.
Yep.
I see where the city council also allocated $94,000 for an assistant director in the police department's Office of Professional Accountability.
Yeah, that was originally cut, and that's one of two staff positions in the OPA, and that was going to be cut. And it's an indication, really, of how little importance the city is placing on the OPA program to begin with, is that they would have cut one of the two staff positions there.
Explain a little bit what the OPA is.
The OPA was the compromise that was put into place about 5 years ago to quell demands for an actual citizen review board, which has not happened.
For the Office of Professional Accountability.
It stands for the Office of Professional Accountability. What it does, it does not have any subpoena power of its own. What it has the ability to do is to review internal police investigations where there's been accusations of impropriety of one sort or another. They don't have the ability to conduct their own investigation, but they can review the police investigation. And it's had some, you know, minor degree of success. The director of the OPA, Sam Pelka, probably has her heart in the right place, but has very little ability to actually do the job that she's being asked to do with the resources that are given to her. And now she was being asked to lose her sole staff assistant, and that position has been restored, but again, without any kind of constituency, without any kind of public demand, that restoration would not have taken place. That came because a lot of people protested.
She might lose it next year, right?
She could very easily use it again next year. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Well, your city dollars hard at work.
Yeah, well, a lot of those restorations in funding happened because people raised a squawk, because people protested. That was the case with the city parks. That's the case with the conservancy. That was the case with all the social service
renewals with
the bookmobile. Mm-hmm. A lot of those came because people were unhappy, and the justification then for the increase in the utility tax was, well, people are, you know, these are social services. People clearly want them, and people are willing to pay for them.
Mm. And their voices were heard at the city council level as opposed to the mayor's level.
As opposed to the mayor's level. Well, the mayor really, what he was doing was giving the, and this is to some degree justifiable. The mayor has a responsibility to provide a balanced budget to city council, and he was giving them options of what to cut, and they restored a number of those, stopped a number of those cuts from happening.
Okay. Well, moving along. They are still counting the ballots here for governor.
Yeah, the new releases yesterday say the lead for Dino Rossi is now 1,920 votes over Christine Gregoire. That's down from about 3,900 earlier this week, or on Thursday actually, and that's the good news. The bad news is that the Rossi lead survives despite a number of ballots from King County being counted this week. I mentioned last week incorrectly that the majority of ballots were from inside King County. I got called out by a listener in regards to that, and that was fair. But about a third of those remaining were from King County last week, and that's no longer the case. A majority of the ballots still to be counted, the provisional ballots and absentee ballots, are from other parts of the state at this point. The good news for the Gregoire camp is that she is not losing that lead in terms of those out-of-state ballots she's doing better than was expected for those out-state ballots. And she still has some ballots in King County as well, which favor her. There was also a court ruling yesterday, which the Democrats won, to challenge the striking of about 900 provisional ballots in King County that were being thrown out because their signatures did not match the signatures on the voter rolls. The Democrats won the ability to go literally door to door and track down some of those voters and try and solve the questions of why those votes were not being counted, why the signatures didn't match, so that their votes can't count. And that could help Gregoire a little bit. So at this point, we're probably another week or two away from knowing who's going to be governor in Washington State, and it really is still too close to call. There's about 40,000 ballots still to be counted overall in Washington State. So a lead of under 2,000 is certainly looks good for Dino Rossi, but it's by no means a slam dunk.
So stay tuned.
Yeah.
Well, and as we were joking about when we first were talking this morning, there's still time to walk your provisional ballot in.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, bouncing back to the Middle East, Arafat passed away this week.
Well, yeah, did he pass away just before we went on the air last week, or was that just after?
I think it was after.
It was after. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he did finally pass away from his mystery ailment, and the funeral was yesterday in Gaza, and we're already hearing a number of people spinning the situation as this is a new opportunity for peace in the Middle East. We've had Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority cabinet, has been labeled the new head of the PLO. We have President Bush on the stumps with Tony Blair saying that there's going to be a Palestinian state within 4 years, and Ariel Sharon is kind of laughing at all of this. It simply isn't going to happen without the cooperation of Israel, and Israel is very much taking a wait and see attitude to see what the situation with the Palestinian leadership shakes out to be and who is going to be there that they can or cannot negotiate with. But at this point, Bush can talk all he wants about having a Palestinian state in 4 years from now, but that can't happen without a willing partner in Israel. And so far, Bush certainly has not shown any inclination to put any kind of pressure on Israel with the leverage that the U.S. has through all the funding that we give Israel and all the diplomatic cover that we give Israel. Has not shown any inclination to put any kind of pressure on Israel to come to the table with any kind of real attempt to broker a meaningful solution for a Palestinian state.
Yeah, but certainly, in addition to obviously nothing could possibly happen without Israel. Then the same is true of the U.S. I mean, we're such key players in it that without us pushing as well.
Need to push the Bush administration to say, look, you know, just saying that you want a Palestinian state in 4 years is not enough. You have to actually do something to make that happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that has made this more difficult is that the U.S. has sided so consistently and so thoroughly with the Sharon government over the last several years with all of its various, extremely controversial initiatives, you know, the wading into the refugee camps and the various offensives that have taken place. Yeah,
initiatives that are destructive to any kind of negotiations.
Yeah, that the U.S. has really forfeited its ability to present itself as a neutral mediator in the conflict. I mean, it was never that neutral to begin with, but in the past, Palestinian leadership has been able to go to Palestinians and say, you know, look, the United States is the only country that can bring Israel to bear. Even though we know that they are very much on the side of Israel, we have to treat them as a neutral negotiator. That's one reason why you haven't seen Palestinian suicide bombers target Americans at all. That has simply not happened, by and large, over the last several years of the Second Intifada, because Palestinian leadership and even Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have recognized that the U.S. is key to any kind of long-term solution.
That could change.
that could change because President Bush has simply been so one-sided in his treatment of this issue and has done so little to actively try and intervene and try and negotiate a solution. Now, if he's saying that he's going to change his administration's approach, if that's what he means by talking about, you know, I have a goal of a Palestinian state in the next 4 years, then that's good. We're all for that. But so far, he hasn't given She hasn't shown that that's the case.
All right. We neglected to cover it last week, and we only have a couple minutes to do this, but quickly, administrative changes that are anticipated. John Ashcroft, of course, stepping down.
Yeah, we've got a new attorney general coming in, and this is a deeply problematic guy also, Alberto Gonzalez. He was originally... supposed to be somebody who was less confrontational or less controversial than John Ashcroft, but this is a guy who, in his previous role for the Bush administration, was the drafter of the legal justification for the use of torture against war and terror prisoners in Afghanistan and then Guantanamo Bay. He had the famous declaration that various provisions of the Geneva Conventions were "quote unquote" quaint. This is the man who's going to be setting the legal tone for the United States for apparently the next 4 years.
If he's approved by Congress.
If he's approved by Congress, which is fairly likely.
Yeah.
You know, the Congress is, the Senate is 55 Republicans, and it's so far anyway, there's been very little suggestion even that a lot of Democrats are going to contest his nomination.
Yeah, which is a shame.
Yeah,
because he shouldn't be even up for consideration. A man who has argued against not even argued against previous legal positions of the U.S. government to honor the Geneva Conventions, but has also made legal determinations that the Supreme Court has overturned.
Yeah, and you know, if you want to talk about moral values and the need for progressives to have moral values and to show our moral values to voters in the heartland or whatever, this is a good example of moral values. Torture is a bad moral value. Let's be very clear about that. It's not a good idea.
Violating the U.S. Constitution, you know, and the Bill of Rights by...
And putting our own soldiers in harm's way by setting a bad precedent.
Yeah, by not allowing trials for detainees and legal representation. That's bad. Bad moral values.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Geoff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a newspaper produced here in town by volunteers. You can find it at places where free publications are given out. You can also find it on the web. All of our current and back issues are at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to donate money, because we can always use that, you have questions, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.